Hey, Captain, how are you?
Good afternoon. Nice. Great
afternoon.
To see you.
Wednesday afternoon. It's 25 past six.
Yeah, it is indeed. I'm on holiday at the moment, as you will have seen by my new shirt.
I didn't notice that. I'm kind of realizing that you've got more shirts than, I don't know, than a German street tailor. There we go. How about that?
I don't know if you can say that now. But anyway, who have we got on the amazing captain's table today, Rex?
Well, okay. To say this guy, if you couldn't pigeonhole him, would be a massive understatement. This gentleman graduated from University College Dublin with the prize of a degree in art history and then a secondary degree in law. He started working in 1993 for the European Commission for the Russian State Privatization Program, which basically, I think, after he left, it just turned out to be a bit of a carve-out for all the oligarchs. So I really don't know how that went.
Right.
That went.
It'll be interesting to listen.
We'll have a chat about that. He's worked for numerous multinationals on many continents, including Pakistan, Shanghai, Thailand, Russia, and the UAE. And he's been bombed twice, shot at, and left for dead by a bunch of Chechenian hitmen in Russia. So that's a good start. Welcome to the captain's table, Pierce Klein.
It's a pleasure to be here. Hi, guys.
Welcome, Pierce. This sounds like a spy novel. That I'm interested to hear about.
If I had a dollar for everyone who said that to me, you know, I'd be a rich man today. That's for sure.
So look, let's just get cracking from early days. Were you a bright student or a bit of a dull mat, or what was the background going into art history and then law, for crying out loud?
I got through. I was okay. I certainly didn't excel, academically. In terms of being top of the class, but
is that why you studied art history?
No, actually, funny enough, that was my choice. I've always had a passion in art. And I think, art, and especially art history, has just, it's such a wide perspective that if you understand the art, you have to understand what's happening in history and society, in music and literature, etc. So it was a really, really wide thing. And I've always been pretty artistic. I think I've got art in the family as well. So art was my first choice I wanted to do.
And presumably after you'd cracked it, you then thought, I know law.
Yeah, funny that.
So you finished the art and then moved to law.
Did a secondary degree.
Yeah, so I kind of did art history and philosophy. And when I was studying philosophy, I studied Aristotelian logic, which I really, really excelled at. I loved it. Mm-hmm. And there's a big link between Aristotelian logic and law. So it's kind of, I suppose you could say it was an obvious progression. In that sense, the reality was that when I came out of college in Dublin, there was no jobs. Yeah. We were in the midst of a recession. Yeah. My first choice would have been to become a professor and a lecturer in art history, but I knew that there was no way.
On the lecturing, by the way.
Absolutely, as a lecturer, so there was no way I was ever going to make that happen. It was never going to work. I had to make a crust.
Okay. So working for the European Commission, right?
That's right, yeah. So that started off as a three-month gig to go to Russia. So my first job was actually living in Russia for 3 months in a place called Vologda, about 500 kilometers north of Moscow, the birthplace of Yuri Gagarin, the first astronaut in space. Yeah. And I just got such a thrill out of living in Russia. It was just, to me, because I was a bit of a Russia follower anyway. I'd read a lot of Russian literature in university. I've lived through, the very, very tumultuous times of the fall of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc falling. I was in Prague in New Year 1989, just after the Velvet Revolution. Mm-hmm. So the whole dissolution, the fall of the Berlin Wall, that was just really, really impacting, really impacted on me. And my view of Russia, I'd watched the Russians or the Soviets in Afghanistan. Mm. They pulled out in 89. Mm. I was, all over that back then.
So it got the ball rolling.
I got the Russia bug. And then when I went in there for 3 months.
Yeah. That was 93.
Yeah, 93.
Yeah.
So it would have been all goodness of knows what's going on at that stage.
Absolutely, it was crazy times.
How much could you buy a tank for at that stage?
Oh, do you know what? You could get someone killed for, at the time, I think it was about $200. I don't know, I was never offered the tank, but, you know, the hitmen were readily available. So $200 was the price.
And you call.
So basically 3 months then turned into, you know, I made a pitch to stay on longer, which I loved. And then I kind of, through any aspiration I had of going back to Ireland and, you know, being a lawyer, I'd kind of made a choice that this is what I wanted to do, was to do the expat thing, and to stay abroad. And, you know, I loved Russia. I got a real thrill out of it. So 3 months turned into 3 years.
You speak Russian?
Never learned Russian, but picked it up in the street, you know. Okay. At my best, I spoke pretty, you know, reasonable Russian, but with really bad grammar. Mm-hmm. But I could understand, you know, pretty much 90%, and I could make myself understood with bad grammar.
Right. So we've got a lot to get through, Piers.
Indeed.
So, from Russia, working with the commission, how long did that last for? And then you got into, more commercial aspects, which has been a large part of your working life.
Indeed. So, as I said, the 3 months turned into 3 years. Okay. And then I spent, you know, a lot of that living in all over different parts of Russia. And one of my customers, because we were selling state assets, and I was doing a lot of the legal stuff.
To oligarchs.
Well, unfortunately, I was at the very low end of the scale. So we were selling more like factories to the likes of, you know, or trying to sell factories to the likes of, you know, Coke, Pepsi, Nestle, Danone, Biscuits, all those kind of guys. So I would kind of look at a lot of the regional laws and the federal laws and try to put together the investment packages.
I can see exactly how that took you into your role working for a large food manufacturer, which is like a global manufacturer.
Indeed.
And through that, and was that initially in Russia as well?
No, my first day working for Nestle, who were a client of mine previously, was when I landed in Pakistan.
Okay.
And
but that wasn't part of the plan, was it?
Well, it was quite funny because I'd taken a little bit of time off before joining them, and to be honest, I'd kind of gone, you know, partying for, you know, quite a few months and had traveled a lot around the world. And I remember coming home and there was stickets all over the house from my parents saying, you know, Nestle have been calling, you know, so, you know, where have you been? You know, this is before my mobile telephones.
Yeah.
So eventually, I called my father.
You didn't get the message on your pager?
No, I didn't have pages. goodness.
Sorry.
But, you know,
Ted, you know what a pager is?
if you don't just watch a film, it's called The Hangover.
But I remember calling my father in the office, and he said, "Well, I've got good news and bad news." I said, "Okay, so, you know, tell me the good news." And he said, "Well, you know, Nestle have called. They've got a country. You're ready to go. So you're shipping off, and you're going." I said, "Okay, great. So what's the bad news?" He said, "You're going to Pakistan." And I went, "What's so bad about Pakistan?" And he just said to me, "Do you remember when we lived in Saudi Arabia?" I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Do you remember there was no bars, there was no socializing, there was no alcohol, there was no parties?" I was like, "Yeah." He goes, "Pakistan's not that different." So that was literally...
That wiped as your face then, didn't it?
To be honest with you, if the truth was exactly that, it's a very different story.
And this because is Pakistan back to the expat life,
Absolutely. Pakistan was phenomenal. You know, it was... You know, very, very sociable. There was just a huge party scene, you know, over there, a huge dinner party scene.
So sociable. You were bombed twice there and shot at there or not? I can't argue.
Well, you know, it was kind of so. I was there probably a couple of months, and it had become a bit of an issue, which was well publicized, about motorbikes pulling up beside people in traffic lights and shooting. And then, you know,
I'm the calendar guy. What year are we now?
We're now in 1990. Let me think about this. Pakistan, 95.
Now, when did the Daniel Pearl thing happen in Pakistan?
Oh God, that was much later.
That was much later. Okay.
Much later. This was the early days.
This
was when Benazir was president.
So this is just Benazir's in charge.
That's right.
And Piers, just to set this straight. So when they're popping caps off at people at Gaza, are we talking about people of Western origin?
Indeed. Yeah. Well, actually, not only that, but, you know, they had killed a female who was a well-known singer. But people of, you know, mainly Western, are people who had, you know, wealth, okay?
Okay.
So what they do is they pull up on a motorbike, two people, guy in the back would pull out a gun, shoot, you know, whoever's in the car, open up the car door, take your wallet, and then they're gone, right?
For money, as opposed to absolutely. Ideological.
Oh, no,
reasons.
Absolutely. It wasn't ideological. Right. It was just pure mistake. Robbery. It was right. just pure robbery, right? So I was...
Why did they ask for the wallet? Sorry.
You think. Because honestly, if somebody pulls a gun and says, can I have your wallet? The chances are you'll just say yes.
There you go, sir.
Right? But no, it's kind of shoot.
They just cut out the middleman, haven't I?
Yeah. So I was coming home from the office late one night, and it was on Upper Mall. I was on Canal Road, and I was at the traffic lights on Canal Road a highway, and a motorbike pulled up beside me. And I noticed them, they noticed me, we were looking at each other, and then I noticed the guy in the back of the motorbike reach into his leather jacket, it was wintertime, and he pulled out this rather large, kind of Dirty Harry style gun, yeah. you know. Mm-hmm. And as he did that, I just went into auto mode, and I just put my foot down, and I went across six lanes of traffic, you know, ran a red light, obviously, managed to avoid getting hit to the other side of... Canal Road, and the lights were actually, the street lights were off the other side. So it was pitch black. So I was driving, and next thing, you know, the shot started. And
they were in pursuit.
They were in pursuit, yes, and so. they shot the car a number of times, you know, and, you know, with an effort to try to shoot me. And I was, you know, luckily, I got home to, I was living in Swedish villas. You know, just behind Main Market, I managed to kind of, you know, get in there. And
did you get a Swedish massage afterwards?
I'll tell you what, I needed one, but unfortunately I didn't. It was Pakistan.
But it was a purely, it wasn't targeted. They saw you. It
wasn't personal.
They were just driving up. They said, oh, here's one.
Wasn't personal.
Okay, great.
It was just a robbery attempt.
Okay.
That was it.
Jeez, well, that
but yeah, that kind of shook.
That would be enough to say, I'm out of here.
But it wasn't.
It wasn't at all. And look, that's just, you know, it happens, I suppose. Right. Okay, so then that was in Lahore. And then a couple of months later, I was living in Peshawar, up in the Afghan border.
Which is beautiful, right?
Which is fantastic. Mm. And the people there, the Pathan people there are just out of this world. The hospitality.
The Khyber Pass, is that near there?
Close by, up by...
Yeah, the Khyber Pass was on Hounslow High Street, which was a fantastic curry house used to go when I was at college.
I think there's a few in Khyber Pass. There's, right. one, yeah, in no, Auckland. There's one in Auckland
is there?
As well. Yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sure there's one in Burr Dubai as well. But
yeah.
But yeah, I was up there, and I was, you know, just literally doing a market visit. I was in a store kind of downtown, and a huge explosion went off and everything crumbled and we were all thrown to the ground. And that wasn't the really scary part. But what happened subsequently was that we managed to get up. I was with a colleague of mine called Adnan. And we dusted ourselves off because all the stores are made of these mud bricks. So it's just everything turns to dust straight away.
Can I just interject and stop you for a second? Just because I want to say stop you for a second, because that's going to be quite difficult with this. Mm. No, I'm joking. What I wanted to ask was, this now, of course, was political, was it? Or was it religious fundamentalism?
Never knew. There was just a huge explosion.
But were there a series of explosions?
That time there was only one explosion, but explosions weren't unusual. Yeah, at that time there was a huge amount of issues with Afghan refugees, with kind of struggle for power within, at the time it was called NWFP. Mm. So it was a turbulent time in Northwest Frontier Province.
I remember hearing about the Bhutto documentary and how turbulent it was.
It was turbulent. Yeah. But, you know, it was, you know, I suppose where it got a little bit more hairy was when we managed to dust ourselves off and managed to kind of extricate ourselves onto the street. And we were walking away from where the epicenter of the bomb was. And next thing, the shouts start coming, you know, kill the American, kill the American.
Where's the American?
And literally, yeah, and obviously they weren't speaking English, but, you know, I had fairly decent Urdu at the time. Yeah.
Did he manage to flash the Irish passport?
Well, funny enough, I was kind of going, kill the American, looking for the American, you know, until I realised that I was the only white guy around.
Right.
So, and the guy I was with, Adnan, just literally grabbed my hand and he said, run. And we ran, you know, with a great crowd of people, you know, running behind us in shalwar kameezes and sandals. Thankfully, we managed to outrun them. To get back to the car.
Top tip for those who want to chase after the American, don't have shalwars, kameez, and have sandals.
And sandals, indeed.
Flip-flops.
So I managed to get back to the safety of the car and get out of that situation. Wow. That was Peshawar. And then only a couple of months later, I was in Islamabad living there, and it was Muharram, which is, you know, a religious festival in Pakistan. where they, you know, they
try and kill Americans.
They mourn the death of the grandson of Muhammad.
Okay.
So it's a very, very emotive time for the Shia community. And what they do, there's a lot of self-flagellation with chains and fish knives, where they, you know, they
flay themselves. Very similar to Catholics in Southern Europe.
Indeed, yes. So I kind of passed by the procession and with a camera in the car, and I couldn't really resist as a young, whatever, 26-year-old or 25-year-old, you know, I kind of stupidly thought I was like a Newsweek or a Time photographer.
Yeah.
So the photographs that I took, which are quite amazing photographs, but they start off from a distance, but then I kind of got closer and closer and closer until I got right into the middle of the crowd. So I'm right in the middle of the crowd with, you know, young kids with blood splashing all over the place as they kind of flay themselves with, you know, fish knives attached to chains. They kind of smash their backs on this. And I'm taking, you know, all these photographs. Yeah, and lo and behold, really not a surprise. You know, my naivety and stupidity, the crowd turned, and all of a sudden it was like, you know, I was like, here we go again, kill the American. So I kind of had to tail it out of there with an awful lot of very, very angry and bloody people, you know, chasing after me.
Wow.
And literally got back to my car, and had to, unfortunately, kind of just put the foot down. With reckless regard for anyone else's safety, other than to get out of there, because it was very clear I was going to get pulled limb from limb.
Do you think you've ever been so stupid again since then?
That's debatable.
I just wanted to know if you thought if you had or not. Anyway, so does that cover Pakistan in terms of tales of derring do and scrapes?
Yeah, I think it does. Like, you know, and, you know, let it be said, you know, Pakistan I absolutely loved.
Of course.
You know, and to this day still have great affinity with Pakistan and still follow politics, you know, in Pakistan, you know, very, very closely.
Yeah.
But, you know, loved it.
Are you still with Unilever at this time?
I was with Nestle. Yeah. That was my first country with Nestle.
So then did you start moving around quite a bit? Because, I mean, there's quite a lot to cover here. I mean, Pakistan, Shanghai, Thailand, Russia again.
Well, yeah, next step was from there, Central Asia was just opening up. As markets, obviously, you know, they were getting their independence from the former Soviet Union.
And what are you doing regionally in these places now?
I was more kind of sales, marketing, distribution.
Yeah.
So kind of leading that, and then setting up a representative office in Uzbekistan, looking after, you know, the five countries of the stands of Central Asia. So Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan.
Is this all kinds of foodstuffs?
Yeah. Everything kind of, you know, coffee, infant dietetics. Yeah. Culinary, ice cream, beverage, water, the full thing. So spent a couple of years then in Uzbekistan, and then obviously in all the other stands, but based myself in Tashkent, which was absolutely marvelous, like one of the most beautiful, beautiful countries and most historic places in the world, and really, really enjoyed my time there. Really enjoyed, and met my wife there, and really just, you know, loved it all. But unfortunately, in, I think it was 1999, February 16, if I'm not mistaken, there was a coup attempt. So there were kind of fundamental Islamic elements in the Fergana Valley, which was again heavily influenced by what was happening in, you know, other parts of, kind of, we'll say, early Al-Qaeda times. So they decided that they'd try to overthrow the government. So there was 6 car bombs planted all over Tashkent. So they blew up the airport, the FSB, which is the successor of the KGB, so the security services. They blew up the National Bank. They blew up the Cabinet of Ministers. There was a gunfight around the Cabinet of Ministers. But, you know, it was all about...
All in one day.
All within a couple of hours, right? In the morning of the 16th of February. And... So the idea was to assassinate the president at the time was, you know, Islam Karimov, and to take out the full cabinet of ministers. And pretty unlucky for
not
us.
Not the Americans this time.
Well, pretty unlucky for us, right? So pretty unlucky for us is that the bombers actually had planned it and they'd lived as neighbors to our office. And instead of leaving evidence behind, they decided that they'd blow up their own house, which actually then took out our office as well.
So here we go again.
With all of us in it, right? You know, and including my wife, Lena, who we worked together at the time. So that kind of blew up the office. And then
basically, you're like Nestle's answer to Kate Haney.
I was just going to say that in a hotel bar.
There's always bloody trouble. That's right. Yeah.
Cats' lives are up to four lives so far. It's good.
So did you move out then after there, obviously?
No. I stayed on there. And then, subsequently, I left Uzbekistan in 2000, beginning of 2000. So I went to, at that stage, I'd kind of done stints in KL and in Manila as well during that time. But then moved over to Paris for a number of months, lived in Paris.
It must have been quite boring after...
It was a bit refreshing, but actually it wasn't boring in the slightest because I was there for St. Patrick's Day when Ireland beat France in the Six Nations.
And Brian O'Driscoll
got his hat-trick, indeed. And I had the pleasure of having my mum and dad over staying with me for Paddy's Day, so that was pretty special.
But you got pretty bombed that night as well, didn't you?
Yeah, the different sense, indeed.
Too soon, Riggs.
We definitely enjoyed that one. But then, kind of relatively quickly then, moved over to Bangkok. And
with Nestle.
With Nestle again, yeah. So then kind of ran a regional role for all of Asia, on a particular project there. So kind of did Bangkok for just over a year or so. Lived in India as well, in Delhi, which was pretty cool. And then moved to Shanghai. And then did, kind of what, 2.5 years or so in Shanghai. Where I had the pleasure of, looking after about 22 offices around China. So literally kind of, I would take a flight on, let's say, Monday morning. And then I would do a province in Monday. I'd do a different province on Tuesday, a different province on Wednesday, come back. And then I have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday back in Shanghai. And then I'd be doing that. So yeah, that was really, really great. I love that.
Okay. So at what stage did you go back to Russia? Because, for the last 4 years, your life hasn't been threatened. So it's getting a bit dull for you.
Yeah, it's getting a bit boring, isn't it?
So, when did you move back to Moscow?
So Moscow went back to Russia in 2003.
Is it going to get interesting again, Piers?
Yeah, unfortunately.
And I think really this is what we've all been waiting for.
Actually. Still with Nestle, though.
Still with Nestle, yeah.
You've been called back to...
So,
this is quite interesting.
Yeah, I went back into Russia. And
this wasn't involved in the KGB.
That's much... Much against the kind of the advice and desire.
I was going to say let him finish, but if we do that, we'll be here till like 8 o'clock.
Kind of went in. I was the youngest market head of Nestle. I think my ego kind of drove a little bit of that decision that how would I ever turn that down as such an accolade, and went in there and how would I put it. It wasn't too long after we got there. There was certain things that were a little strange, right? Mm. From some very large acquisition that we'd made. And things maybe had slipped past the audit process, et cetera. So we kind of started to address that, okay? So by addressing that, I pretty much cleared out
The suppliers or the owners?
Well, pretty much everybody, all the staff, most of the staff, top management, et cetera, et cetera. The same day...
I'm sensing something.
Yeah, the same day, then, an army of, Godzilla personal bodyguards turn up. Okay.
Were they from a particular region, do you think?
Well, no, the bodyguards were her all ex-military. But what we found out that actually what we had to deal with was... Chechens, okay,
and similar to a mafia type organization.
Absolutely, yeah. They pretty much control the wholesale market. And as I said, there was
the hotel market.
No, the wholesale.
Oh, wholesale.
Russia, and the previous owners of this particular company had, a special arrangement.
Okay.
With them, which
you'd driven a truck through, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. And look, this came from the ruble, the Russian ruble crisis, when they were trying to sell the company to Nestle, and they had made some kind of unsavory arrangements, which we then figured out. But that obviously then, as you say, I drove a truck through that.
And this
then
was pretty much a personal thing as opposed to a whole entity. It's you.
Yeah, no. I was the MD, so therefore, the buck stopped with me, and I was the one who kind of stopped, all this stuff going on. So therefore, I was the target.
And obviously, there was a bit of covert messaging or overt,
Oh, it was very overt. Yeah. They were very clear. So they had code names for, at the time, my daughter, Shauna, she was the brat. My wife, Lena, was the bitch.
Dealing with a nice crowd there, then, obviously.
Yeah, they were lovely. Yeah. They were very savoury.
Yeah.
And we would get text messages.
And how did it start off? Through messages?
Yeah, it was just text messages. Yeah. Because this was before smartphones. It was the old Nokia phones. So it was just text messages. They did all sorts of terrible things. They advertised my wife Lena in the newspapers as a prostitute. So we'd get and our home number as well. So people would call our home number in the middle of the night, looking for a bit of action.
Just to make your life so difficult, you'd leave.
Yeah, and they followed us around. We got I got photographs in the Post of my family members. So we had 24/7.
So I was going to say, so it then geared up very quickly.
Well, it geared up very, very quickly. And we had armed 24 protection on both myself, Shauna, who was in kind of preschool at the time. So we'd have like a great Godzilla, standing in the classroom or in the schoolyard. Same with Lena. She would go shopping with her friends, and there might be a great big Godzilla, 5 meters behind. And literally everywhere I went, there was an armed guard, everywhere we went. And we took the usual precautions, so no routine. So we left at a different time, took a different route to the office, came back at a different time, different routes. So absolutely no routines whatsoever.
And how long did this go on for, pretty much?
About 2 years.
Jeepers.
But how did it kind of manifest itself? Because obviously I know the outcome of the story, but just maybe you can give us a little insight to what happened, and because it's a fundamental and major part of your life.
Yeah, well, look, at the end of the day, as I said, I suppose the fact that I'm Irish and I'm stubborn, I kind of thought...
I'm stupid,
possibly. But I thought, to hell with this, they're not going to get away with this. I'm going to stand for my principles of what's right, etc. But we used to walk around with, business class tickets for Air France and Lufthansa everywhere we went, because they had flights on successive days. And there were occasions where I just literally have to call Lane and say, listen, no matter where you are, right, go to the airport and leave, right? So I got them out of the country a couple of times because, things were getting a little hairy. So we kind of lived that life, for 2 years. Yeah, which is kind of tough. And I think, at the end there was, and keep in mind, every single moment of every single day, there was somebody probably within 10 feet of myself, Shauna, Lena, carrying a gun, right? Every moment of every day, right?
As protection,
right? And it so happened after 2 years, for particular circumstances, that there was 45 minutes.
Your eyes off the ball.
45 minutes. I told my bodyguard, that he was fine, I was okay.
You were out socializing with some friends.
I was out socializing with some friends, and I said, listen, you're fine, it's okay. We had an argument. He wouldn't let me be alone. I said, listen, you're absolutely fine, it's okay, go.
And this was traveling out of
Moscow,
we were
just outside, we weren't far outside Moscow, but I was with some friends, and as I said, 45 minutes. And that's all it took.
Well, you say that's all it took. I mean,
I'm waiting for it to be continued. So,
exactly. So you weren't shot and you weren't bombed.
No.
But you were in a public place.
I was in a public place, and they put it this way: they did more than they needed to leave me dead.
They filled you in.
I was very, very lucky. Very, 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 very lucky to survive and to be able to walk again.
Head was smashed in.
Indeed.
And you really remember nothing about it, of course.
No, not at all.
What was the outcome of that? Do you want to go into a little bit of detail?
Well, it was just a little bit. I don't want to get into too much detail on it, but obviously I couldn't leave. I couldn't get medevaced out straight away because I had brain swelling. So I was in the European Medical Center in Moscow, and I was doing, you know, CAT scans and, you know, on a daily basis to see when the brain swelling would go down. And eventually when it did, then I got medevaced out and I went back to Dublin and then went literally into Beaumont Hospital.
And you were hospitalized for how long?
Oh, look, you know, I was an outpatient, treated as an outpatient. But, you know, yeah, it took, you know, quite a few months to kind of get the wires working again.
I'm talking about wires working. I mean, you know, you got the $1 million smile now, haven't you? Because you had a whole load of reconstructive.
Yeah, I had a bit of reconstruction going on, but, you know, kind of, you know, short-term memory loss and, you know, stuff like that as well.
So and traumatization of PTSD, all of that.
A little bit of that as well.
And you've talked about it, and, you know, when we're having beers over it, and you can embellish a little bit more, but you've never really touched on how, and I never really thought about the trauma that's attached to that and how difficult that must have been to get over. That certainly would have been the end of your Russian experience, I'm pretty sure.
Well, it's not the last time I've been in Russia. I've been in Russia many times since then.
No, but you'd think that obviously everything is off once they've done their trip.
Yeah, look, you know, to be honest with you, I think, you know, it's fair to say that I'd, when that happened, I kind of lost my bottle for my desire for travel and adventure.
No, sure.
So we moved, you know, quite abruptly. We kind of moved back to Ireland and, you know, bought a house and settled down and said, okay, right, this is it. So we'll just take the nice, easy life from here. And that last.
Did you buy a cardigan or?
No, nor slippers. But, you know, having said that, as I said, you know, the easy life and the kind of the Irish way, you know, I think within about 2 years, you know, the itchy feet started coming again.
Understand. And you said, I want to go to the next thing.
And does that lead us to this part of the world?
It does indeed. It does indeed.
And thank goodness, because this is called Dubai Stories.
It is.
I'm starting to get a bit worried.
Yeah, no, I was breaking into a cold sweat. So you were working with Dell for a very long time.
Yeah, so I joined Dell in Ireland, Dell Technologies, which was, you know, again, a complete right turn, which a very old... wise man called David Eade, who, God rest his soul, he's left now. But he said, every 10 years, you take a right turn, do something completely different in your life. So I've kind of tried to follow that, you know, that rule a little bit. I went...
Not get your face caved in, or get shot, or get bombed. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, so I went from kind of, you know, art to law to, you know, to Russia doing, you know, privatization stuff, that into FMCG, then I decided to go into tech. So, you know, tech then became the thing for the next, you know, 16 years. So, as I said, you know, started in Ireland and then moved over to Dubai. Dubai was really important for us, I think, as a family. We were very, very, very keen to bring up our kids in a very multicultural environment. Having, you know, done the expat thing for about 13, 14 years, you know, previous to that. And we saw Dubai as this amazing place of tolerance, of multiculturalism, of, you know, the melting pot of all nationalities, all coming together into this really cool society where everyone just, you know, gets along well together without prejudging, you know, stuff like that. And we wanted our kids to have that. That experience. We also wanted our kids to be able to have a little bit kind of the expat thing as well, by saying that you're not necessarily tied to any one place, but you can literally hold the globe in your hand, spin it, and just go, I want to go there, and feel that they have the ability, you know, in every way to just be who they want, where they want, anywhere in the world, and to hold the world in their hand. And I think Dubai, you know, kind of offered a lot of that. And to be honest, it's a beautiful place, and the weather's great most of the time. So
there are certain tax advantages as well.
There are certain tax advantages as well.
Yeah. I was waiting for that.
Yeah. So yeah. So we moved over here, 14 years ago, and then, you know, got back on the road. So I ran the Middle East for a while.
Wide catchment area, right?
Yeah. Wide catchment area. So Middle East initially, and then, you know, emerging markets. Which went right across Middle East, Africa, Turkey, Central Eastern Europe, Russia, etc. So Russia became part of my territory again. So I was back into Russia again. So that's magnetic, you know, force that keeps dragging me back there. And, you know, and enjoyed, you know, my time, you know, doing that. And then ran all of EMEA and then global. Mm. So kind of, you know, again, you know, I suppose, you know, utilizing my experience of, you know, wandering around, you know, Asia as well. So I spent a huge amount of time in Western Europe, you know, as well as then going everywhere from, really from China to, you know, to the US.
18 years with Dell.
16 years with Dell. Yeah. Mm. So, you know, really phenomenally good. And, you know, 14 of which were based here in Dubai. So, you know, an awful lot of travel. So probably 50% of my time, you know, I'd spend, you know, out of Dubai and the rest of the world, and then 50% of the time. Yeah. Indeed, where I met your wife, know, we had a good night out.
Had a sociable time in the evening with a friend of hers.
Indeed.
Anyway, not enough about that, but more about you. And let's talk about Dubai and where you are now, what you're doing. Actually, what we always tend to do, and you've touched on it, is say, what are the good things that you love about
Dubai? What's I think you did touch on it a lot with your reasons there, but you know what's and probably the same things, the reasons that you remain here and why you love this place so much.
Look, I think after 14 years, you know, Dubai is very much part of our, you know, our long-term plans.
Sure.
You know, we feel very, very comfortable here. It's home. Mm. You know, even though, you know, my wife is from Uzbekistan, so she's Russian from Uzbekistan. You know, Sean, our eldest, was born in Thailand, has lived in India, China, Russia, whatever. You know,
the other two were
born in Ireland and are, you know, lived pretty much all their lives here. So it's very much home. So, you know, certainly the plan would be that we will always maintain a base here in Dubai. I think, you know, we'd like to kind of have a second base maybe in Ireland, you know, to spend a bit of time in Europe and then a bit of time here. But yeah, I think that the whole Dubai experience has been really good to us. And you know, long may it last. You know, we love it here. And I think we love the openness of it. I think, you know, the friendships that we've built here have been, you know, amazing. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. And the opportunities.
You know, and the opportunities. And look, and again, and I know you kind of, you said you want to get into the next steps, but I also think that there's, Dubai is a place of amazing innovation and creativity, okay? And not only from, you know, a government perspective, but I think that trickles down all the way down to the individual. So, you know, so we're spending, I'm spending an awful lot of time now doing kind of, you know, investment stuff, you know, as I've now decided to pursue, you know, a different path, you know, so I've kind of finished up with Dell and I'm kind of just, you know, pursuing my own personal interests at this stage. But within that, for sure, the opportunities that present themselves here in Dubai, you would never get visibility to those kind of, and they're global opportunities. Okay, they really are global.
It's such a similar story we hear from so many people that sit in that seat.
I'm sure. Because it's true. And I, you know, if you click into it, and if you can get into
it's a very rich seam of
it's absolutely it's fantastic
of talent and source of great stuff. We've always talked about it. You know, the 2 degrees of separation of Dubai as opposed to 6 or 7 elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary. Mm. And if you the time you invest over here is the time that what you get out of it.
So absolutely. And look here, honestly, you know, if you're not loving Dubai, you know, this, you know, maybe the hills of Tuscany are beautiful and you want to go hill walking all day long, which we can't do here. Mm. But it doesn't mean you can't do that in summertime and then still have your winters here. So you know, the long-term plan is definitely to have, you know, winter sun here.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we've got Rory and Chloe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Rory's just finished his GCSEs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, very, very proud of him. He's absolutely smashed it. You know, Chloe is absolutely smashing it. She's a brilliant ballerina, you know, but, you know, she's decided that she's going to stay here and kind of not pursue ballet, despite her getting offers from, you know, some of the most amazing, you know, the best schools in the world to pursue her ballet career. But, you know, it's a family place that is very much close to our hearts, and long may it last, as I said.
Brilliant. Well,
that's a great way to wind up, isn't it?
It's a great story. It did have all the, and we could be talking for hours on this, and maybe we have to get you back on to go on a bit deeper. But thanks for opening up so much, because it's pretty hard to sort of say all those changes that you've had, but Thank you so much for the beer tour.
It's my absolute pleasure, guys.
Thanks for joining the table, mate.
Yeah. Pleasure.
Today on the captain's table, we have an Irishman who's known for talking a lot. I'm actually going to ask him and see if he can give me one word answers. Can you do that?
I can try. Here you go.
Let's try again, shall we? Did you go to UCD?
Yes.
Have you got 2 degrees?
Yes.
Were you bombed, shot, and left dead by the Chechen mafia?
Yes.
There you go. You hit it here first. One word answers almost.
Great chat with Piers today. I tell you what, I've certainly learned a few things. Rex? Piers, what'd you think?
Loved it. Thank you very much, guys, for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I'm a big fan of the Captain's Table, so I'm honored to be here.
Great. So if you want to hear more of these great stories, like, comments, YouTube.